Hey everyone, Raven here. Today we're talking with Dr. Lorenzo Aranda, PsyD. Dr. Aranda is a clinical psychologist for the United States Air Force. There, he dives deeper into mental health research regarding the military and veteran populations and the techniques currently used to treat them. Also during this episode, you'll hear from our South African correspondent, Jordan Curl. He's a former U.S. Marine, now turned cannabis educator and founder of Growers Without Borders. So join me as we welcome Dr. Lorenzo Aranda to the show for his military perspective. Also, a quick disclaimer, while I make every effort to broadcast correct information, I myself am still learning. I promise to double-check all my facts, but I realize that plant medicine is a constantly changing science and art. So the views and opinions expressed on this show are intended purely for educational and informative purposes. No topics are intended to be construed as medical advice. Awesome. Thank you, Lorenzo, for joining us today. I love all the work you're doing for education and keeping yourself abreast of all the research in plant medicine, but also you're out there serving the veterans in a clinical psychology perspective. So I'd love to hear your story and kind of how you got involved with the military, especially in the clinical psychology aspect.
Sure. Well, I knew I always wanted to be a psychologist ever since high school when I was helping out friends with their personal problems. It just seemed to be something that grew on me, and to find out that it was an actual profession that I could make money with just made it even all the more appetizing. So then I just structured my education from that point on. As far as my desire to focus specifically on the military population, that came along a little bit later. One of the things that kind of inspired that was seeing my grandfather on a regular basis, because he was a veteran of World War II. He was from an era where it was kind of like you got back home and you couldn't possibly speak about the atrocities that you saw because nobody would understand. So you bottled it up, and sometimes you released it in the form of drinking out of a bottle, right? And so he was a very quiet man. We didn't know the full extent of his involvement in World War II until we found his trunk after his death. So it really was kind of a family secret. And to know that that there was a whole generation of veterans out there who didn't have the outlet for being able to convey the distress they were experiencing internally made me want to be able to focus at least on our current military members.
Yeah, that makes sense. And that's definitely dutiful work and admirable. And being able to see your grandfather kind of struggle with, in his own way, PTSD, and being able to contribute back to that and benefit the soldiers that are currently coming out with other military engagements is definitely admirable. I'm curious, you mentioned that you kind of watched him dive into the bottle to be able to numb and get over some of the traumas that he experienced during wartime.
No, he remained quiet. His silence was enough said, but I did know of other veterans from the same period, and especially the Vietnam period, that seemed to follow that method of self-medicating.
I see. Do you think that possibly plant medicine might be an acceptable alternative in the future?
Oh, absolutely. In the right controlled environment, the right dosage, with the right supervision, the science that's coming out now, once the government started loosening up its regulations on clinical trials, a lot of promising things are coming our way.
Yeah, definitely. I agree with that wholeheartedly. Now, I know that you remain abreast with plant medicine research and kind of keep on the cutting edge of that. And I'm curious, in your particular field, I know that the U.S. military has recently banned CBD throughout its troops. Conversely, the Canadian military has approved cannabis use as a alternative to alcohol and kind of follow the same rules and regulations whenever they're off duty. Do you see something like that ever happening in the U.S. military? And if not, kind of what's the barrier there?
Well, the reason why they banned it was essentially because a lot of the products that contain CBD, they're unregulated, and therefore various trace amounts of THC seep into them, right? And it's the THC really that the military is concerned about. So, you know, as you are fully aware, the CBD is the therapeutic benefit. The THC is that high. And as we found out from a lot of these dispensaries nationwide, is that they're starting to carry strains that are specifically tailored towards enhancing the THC and unfortunately reducing the CBD or the therapeutic benefit. So it's destroying the entire reason the process was legalized in the first place, which was the medical benefit. That's how it was initially advertised to legislatures.
Yeah, I definitely see where you're coming from there, especially with saying that the current CBD on the market is largely unregulated due to the 2018 Farm Bill. A lot of it that hits the market, like you said, does have trace amounts of THC. And not only that, there's not really uniform standardized extraction processes or testing processes to really put that provide any type of
Exactly.
authentication.
And that's why the military just had to create this blanket policy of we're just not going to allow any of it because they don't have the resources to keep up with the products as they're released to test them themselves. And it's to some extent, it's the same problem just with the fitness products. A lot of the supplements, either by themselves or in combination, pop as human growth hormone on urine analysis. And it's hard for the military to keep up with that.
Oh yeah, hugely. That's a very, very good way to put it. The paradigm between CBD and THC. Of course, we know CBD is more the therapeutic, non-psychoactive, non-intoxicating is what I like to say, non-intoxicating effects. But THC, albeit intoxicating, definitely does have its medicinal value. And I'm kind of curious that even talking strictly recreational, if we look at the amount of alcohol-related incidents or the amount of alcohol use in certain populations, do you think that recreational cannabis could be a possible alternative?
The response to that, it comes from many directions and it's a very complicated situation. But what we know, so one of the initial pieces of research that came out of looking at Colorado, which was sort of the landmark state for legalization, is there were a lot of docs in pediatrics complaining that their pregnant mothers or their recently birthing mothers had taken doses of marijuana or CBD products during the course of their pregnancy. And their justification was that we're, you know, it's legal now, so why not? Or it's just a plant, you know, various forms of excuses because they haven't been properly educated. And what we've seen come out of the children under those circumstances is increased rates of ADHD, just generally difficulties with academics. And in some cases, mental health disorders.
Yeah, absolutely. I've also dug into that research myself. A lot of people will ask me whenever it comes to using cannabis, either when they're pregnant or whenever they're breastfeeding, because they'll lean to it for the antiemetic properties, so that to help with the morning sickness, to help with some of the post, missing the word here, but the depression that comes in whenever after you have a baby, being
Yeah,
able to kind of
postpartum.
postpartum, thank you,
Right.
being able to kind of counteract those effects, but then also caring for the safety of your baby is always everyone's number one concern and priority. What I've found is that not like, let's say, nicotine or tobacco, where it's proven to be teratogenic and cause birth defects. It seems a lot of what I've read, as far as like the mental executive processing, executive functions, mental disorders and stuff, seems to balance out with age, as long as the child isn't exposed to cannabis or THC at a really young age, or like a whenever they're a teenager or an adolescent as well. So yeah, I
Yeah,
think
I
that's
mean,
definitely.
that's the other level of concern is that chronic exposure during adolescence, that it can also cause memory issues and you know problems with speed of functioning you know neurologically. The problem is that there's a lot of confounding variables, and a lot obviously a
Yes.
lot of teenagers are dipping themselves into other questionable activities, including alcohol, which conflates the situation, right? But we know that the adolescent brain is still continuing to develop until early to mid 20s, sometimes late 20s, and so you want to give it the opportunity to do so without infusing any external substances, right?
Yeah, I agree with that.
I've got just something I want to input on that is, you know, one of the things we noticed when Washington created its separate regulated form of recreational cannabis, we actually saw an uptick in synthetic cannabinoid use in youth. Because what ended up happening is because it was 21 and above, people were doing what they were doing with alcohol, where they were doing a, hey, mister, can you go buy this for me? You know, with the homeless
Right.
population, with other people. And what they would do is go buy synthetic cannabinoids that were still cheaper than regularly grown cannabis at the store and pocketing the difference. And we were actually seeing multiple reports. I think there was like 20, I believe, during 2016 in Seattle, of just children overdosing on the synthetic because there's just a lack of knowledge about the plant knowledge. And I knew that was a big issue when I was in 2011 and 2012. And I personally think it was a fallout from a policy issue because a lot of people were just trying to avoid drug tests. And so, you know, that's why I think it's a very multidimensional question when you ask, like, you know, if this could replace alcohol, because, you know, alcohol is really a tricky subject in military culture, because there's, for me personally, there are so many times where I should have had a bottle taken away from me, but instead it was just kind of swept under and kept kind of, you know, within the chain of command, or it was kept at a certain level when maybe I should have been put in a rehabilitation program, or I should have been put somewhere else. And so, you know, with reality and policy meeting each other is kind of where the middle ground is. What I'm hoping to see in the future with, like, how the states is, like, moving towards possible rescheduling and whatnot.
Yeah. Plus, we know there's some definite variations in addictive properties between the two. Right. They're almost night and day. Alcohol, you know, there's a reason why we have a lot of alcohol rehabilitation programs, and you don't have, like, you know, marijuana Malibu clinics. Right.
With that said, I do kind of want to piggyback off of Jordan's, what he mentioned there. In 2011, I was graduating high school. There was a lot of K2, a lot of spice, JWH-018, a lot of these synthetic cannabinoids that were around that you don't really see now. I mean, now we're looking more at like the Delta-A, the HHC, the THCP and stuff. In your particular field, have you noticed an uptick, or how have the synthetic cannabinoids or synthetic cathinones and the opioid epidemic kind of affected the armed forces?
In general, we find that because of the ambiguity about, you know, if I take this substance, I don't know if it's necessarily going to show up on a random urine analysis test, that the fear of repercussion or the desire to preserve one's career ends up taking the forefront and results in abstinence more often than not.
That makes a lot of sense. I went out to Seattle a few years ago, and I had a friend who was active duty Navy at the time. And I, of course, wanted to go in the dispensary, and he couldn't even walk inside. I definitely understand what you mean whenever we're talking about careers and stuff. Abstinence is definitely going to be the option there. But with that said, I mean, alcohol is generally accepted, though.
And that is the funny substance, because depending on what branch of the military, and even more specifically than that, what your duty or your job is in the military, there's often a culture around consumption of alcohol with some of those, because it's you know, they would claim that it helps with, you know, cohesion. You know, you have a rough day on a convoy op, and then, you know, it's nice to unwind and kind of joke around about it afterwards. But the consequence of all that is that now you're treating what was potentially a traumatic incident with the use of alcohol. The two are paired now, and in some cases inseparably.
In that case, once people, or maybe whenever they're still enlisted, and once they leave duty, what tools and mechanisms are they given to deal with these traumatic incidents currently? I know that you spoke a little bit on your grandfather not having the resources there, so I'm curious as to what resources we provide now for our vets.
Yeah, so looking more towards modern day, we have built up a more robust VA system, especially in the aftermath of poor scrutiny by media outlets and by legislation. And as a result, there's a lot more funding, a lot more personnel, and sharpening of the programs available. But what we still found as that was moving along is that there was a disconnect between the moment that the service member leaves their organization and being received by the VA system, that sometimes there was weeks to months in between where they just kind of felt abandoned in this gray area. And so we partnered with an organization called In Transition. And In Transition is exactly how the title sounds. So what we do these days is, as we're preparing the service member to exit the service, when they conduct their last session with mental health, we provide them a brochure and a short description of the In Transition services, let them know that they're going to be assigned a case with a liaison that will facilitate any treatment needs that they may have in that interim period between their service commitment and their transition to the VA.
Wow. Yeah. It sounds like there's definitely been some major improvements done with your education. I would love to know, like, what further improvements you would personally think that we should take in that transitionary period. Mm-hmm. How could we improve that process? Because it sounds like we've done a lot compared to, you know, previous generations of soldiers.
I would say more of a deep dive into the unconventional forms of treatment, some things that we wouldn't even consider treatment, like unit organized events to help build camaraderie, barbecues and stuff like that. You know, some of the soldiers would call that mandatory fun. And on the front end of these events, they roll their eyes and complain. But, you know, if you were to interview them on the back end of such events, they would, you know, find that the benefit was undeniable. They had a few laughs, told a few stories, got to know some of their peers a little bit better. So those kinds of things. We've seen in studies that, you know, a sense of belongingness is a huge protective factor to mental health issues, but especially to depression that leads up to suicide. And if we can put programs into place, or, you know, formally or informally, that'll help build that cohesion with others, that's going to be your best bet right there.
Yeah, I agree with that wholeheartedly. In my field, I've spoken with a lot of veterans who have taken on, and I'm in Pennsylvania, and a lot of our security personnel or transportation personnel within the cannabis industry are vets. And I've talked with a lot of them, and they discussed that the biggest thing for them in terms of transitioning in order to combat that depression or combat military trauma is to simply give them something to do, be that trim a plant, grow a plant, give them something therapeutic to do, and they can build that camaraderie around them.
Well, you know, and that's, I think that that's an important comment that you make. And an unfortunate thing is that the veteran organizations, like American Legion, they've dwindled in numbers over the last several years to the point where a lot of those posts have had to shut down and close shop all over the country. And it's unfortunate because we're now experiencing, you know, the whole post 9/11 generation of veterans that don't really see the buy-in to joining those organizations. And the buy-in is exactly what we just talked about, but nobody's communicating to them. And so they're not joining, they're not going to their local VFW post and sitting down and, you know, talking about shop with the guys around them. Instead, a lot of them are isolating because they're unable to connect with those that share the same experiences.
I see. So there's almost like a divide between, would you say it's generational or like kind of pre or post 9/11?
I would say it's generational. When you look at previous conflicts, as recently as the Gulf War, even where they didn't have a lot of access to those creature comforts that a lot of deployed members have now, namely Wi-Fi, right? Attached to that, gaming systems, right? So instead of going to play basketball, cards, just sitting around a table and talking with your peers, instead you're going back to your quarters and video gaming for hours on end. So you finally realize, oh, it's 2 a.m. I need to get up at 6, so I might as well go to sleep. It's a very unhealthy pattern that the short-term gratification awarded by the gaming or by going on Netflix all night, it really comes as a consequence to the long-term gratification that comes with feeling connected.
Yeah, I agree with that wholeheartedly. And that kind of segues into my next question. I mean, you mentioned that we have the creature comforts in our current military bases, which I think that the division that you're speaking of is something that's not unique to the military personnel. I think that division is definitely all over the world. People are likely to isolate themselves. But I'm curious, you mentioned a little bit about the creature comforts there. Regarding all that, we still know that the military is one of the most stressful jobs that people can enlist in. What kind of stress mechanisms and what kind of tools do you recommend for people that are finding themselves either in a military or non-military lifestyle?
Ooh, that's a broad question. So you're asking me what tips and tricks I could offer people to get on top of the stresses that they're battling?
Let me put it this way. Because you work specifically with a population who is one of the highest tension, highest stress work populations there can be, not to mention your clinical background and your SID, what insights you can bring for people in the military or outside the military that may be listening that are curious about ways they can reduce their overall stress.
Okay. So first of all, I want to say that stress is potentially healthy, right? We know that, right? Low levels of stress are a motivating factor.
The Wim Hof method.
Right, exactly. So it's only when it gets out of hand that it becomes maladaptive and counterproductive, right? But one thing that I work on with a lot of my patients, because I if they have depression, if they have anxiety, and they correspond to the requirements of the disorder, the diagnostic criteria, then I call them dysfunctional time travelers. And what I mean by that is people with anxiety, they tend to, their mind travels to the future too much, and they tend to stay there too long. They tend to catastrophize about things that have yet to occur when they don't have all of the variables controlled for. People who have depression, they tend to travel to the past quite often and stay there too long. They tend to ruminate about things that have already occurred, either, things will never be as good as they were back then, or things were always terrible in the past, so why do I, think they'll be any different in the future, right? So what I try to work on with those patients is bringing them back to the present and residing there as long as possible, until it becomes a self-sustaining pattern. And another way of referring to that is mindfulness practices, right? That's that sense, creating that sense of presence. And it does require the mind to be trained. Just like if you were to, want a six-pack abs, you got to go to the gym on a regular basis and work that particular muscle. In the muscle of the mind has to be trained on a regular basis. And, whether that's 2 to 5 minutes a few times a day, or you could work yourself up to a 30 to 60 minute meditation in the evenings, that's something that needs to be sustained over time.
It's really interesting that you say that, because I believe the same, that anxiety and depression are, that's a great way to put it, as mental time travelers, because we're preoccupied with the time that's not currently present right here, right now, which is ironic, because that's the only time we ever have. So it's very interesting to see that our brain has ways to kind of maneuver and ways to catastrophize and lock us down in these. So I think that even something as simple as a mindful meditation practice is something really, really powerful. And it's nice to know that in your field, working with veterans and working with enlisted soldiers, that that's still as effective as it can be,
Yes, it's still part of evidence-based treatment. Absolutely.
Exactly. I'm curious.
Alcohol is one of the oldest plant medicines that exists in the world. And I really like what you had to say about what some of the best times I had was the 2 beers with my unit just after a training session or getting in the UAE. Like, even though we did roll our eyes at the mandatory fun days, those were a stress reliever. It did create that unit cohesion, which created a better, more combat effective model that I think, and in the right place and time, ethanol does have its place in the toolbox. From my personal point of view, I really think that everything you've said so far is lined up with what I've seen in the field and what I've seen with the veterans also coming out in the last 10 years. Because I do think there is a separation in generations and how quickly returning from war has had an effect on their ability to decompress from the traumas that they experience. You look at World War II, traveling on a boat home for a few months and being with your comrades is a form of decompression versus today I'm in Afghanistan, tomorrow I'm in Vegas. That alone is enough to be a traumatic shock, let alone coming from, say, a traumatic situation that may have lasted for 9 months, 7 months, something like that. And so I think, time plays a big role in it. I think nutrition plays a big role with it. But it wasn't until I started being holistic with being mindful and spiritual and actually seeking out a fellowship. And it's interesting because between all the psychedelics or plant medicines and other things, the common themes that I seem to find is the fellowship, right? If you look at AA, they talk about the fellowship. You look at the military, you're talking about fellowship, finding one's place inside whatever community or tribe they seem to want to exist in,
And funny you mentioned that. I was just, not too long ago, having a briefing with a general and his team. Of course, we had a bunch of mental health providers in the room, but also the chaplain services, because oftentimes in the military, we're used interchangeably and worked hand in hand in a lot of areas. And one of the chaplains got on and said, what I've seen and what I've read, spirituality is the number one thing to fix the problem with the mental health crisis right now. And I bit my tongue because it wasn't my time on the soapbox. But one of the things that we're granted with critical thinking that comes with a doctorate in clinical psychology is always looking at alternative explanations, right? So spirituality is a pretty large and general construct, and you gotta break that down into parts. What comes with being spiritual? Oftentimes we're referring to those that are religious, and if you're religious, oftentimes there's a gathering place. And if there's a gathering place, you see these folks on a regular basis, you share a common interest, you create a bond. Oh, so maybe it's bonding that's part of that, or a large part of that even. So you see what I'm saying?
Oh yeah, absolutely. I agree. I think that community building, that bonding, I mean, even if you're at like your favorite concert or something, just looking and seeing that all these people are around you are all there for the same exact reason is incredibly, it's breathtaking, but it's also therapeutic in a way.
Oh yeah. I know that from going to Electric Daisy Carnival.
Yeah. To piggyback off of that, I'm curious what your opinions, either personal or professional, are on like the more classic psychedelics and how they're coming up in research for PTSD and treating depression, anxiety. Because one thing that we often see whenever we're researching these is the profound interconnectedness that people feel, that patients feel whenever they use them. And I think that if we're piggybacking off of how therapeutic that is, what kind of concerns or ideas do you have whenever it comes to the more classic psychedelics like psilocybin or LSD or even MDMA for the treatment of PTSD?
Oh, okay. And let's not forget ketamine, because
Yeah,
that's another
exactly. Yep.
prevailing one right now. So the problem is you could almost see the vulture circling the in the private sector waiting for some of these to be legalized. And what we've seen specifically with ketamine is the corporate abuse is already starting. So one thing that came out of COVID and quarantine is a loosening of regulations regarding telehealth, right? And there's a lot of exploitation of that now regarding, you know, what constitutes therapy. I mean, for crying out loud, you've got apps now where you're claiming to offer therapy done through text messaging. What's the quality of therapy in that mode? I would question that significantly. But you know, there's companies out there. I think the two big ones are like Mind You or something like that, and the other one's Mind Bloom. Yeah. So just because you know, preparing for this conversation today, I just did some deep diving, clicking around their website. You know, at the risk of getting sued for slander, I will say that there's a lot of questionable activities being done by that site. One, to say that that they're offering services supervised, that's questionable. Now, while you do some of these virtual engagements before and after the sessions where you interact with the ketamine, those sessions are by yourself and they're unguided. Additionally, the website refers to a lot of their research based on the intravenous use of ketamine, which has a lot more robust research behind it than taking it under the tongue. So that there's a difference there. Plus, a lot of people on the surface think they're getting one-on-one coaching, but that actually costs extra above and beyond the medication package. And I did some looking into. I mean, anybody could do this. You get on the website, you look at careers that they offer, look at the requirements for being one of these guided coaches and for being, what do they call them, a psychedelic guide or integration coach. Verbatim, the experience needed is you have to have a track record of successfully coaching clients and completing a program training certificate in a relevant field.
That's
Well,
pretty broad.
that could be I did a three-day workshop online, right? Kind of like with the whole personal coaching field. That's, you know, kind of a wild, wild west.
Yeah, exactly. That's the first thing that came to mind whenever you said have experience coaching. It's like that's a lot of people if you really want to cut their experience, you know?
Right. And the level of dosing that they're using is also a little bit lower than what you would hope to achieve from having what's called a therapeutic trip.
Yeah, exactly.
So
I would
there's
love to get someone that's like a mind bloom patient on here just to kind of pick how that program's been for him, you
Oh yeah, that would definitely spice things up
know?
right now.
Do you think that there's potential in things that you wouldn't normally consider therapy, similar to how these mandatory fun days, you wouldn't normally consider that to be a form of therapy, but it ends up being one. Do you think that there's a value in the future if we kind of get more research out? What do you think needs to be done in order to provide that value for our troops?
Well, I think that individual entities can't be trusted to self-monitor the quality of administrating those treatments. It has to be something under federal regulations that that dictates how that's done. These online forms of distributing the medication, mail order, it's got to be under control. That's got to be nixed right off the bat. You have to be sitting in the room with the patient, offering step-by-step guidance on their interactions with the trip. All right. Because there's the potential to actually worsen the condition, right? If specifically, if you're taking it to move through any trauma you might've experienced in the past, especially some of those more deeply rooted traumas that, you know, from childhood origin. If you unpack all that through the use of this substance and you're not processing it appropriately, which somebody knows how to address it, then you come out of that even worse than you were before, potentially.
Oh, yeah. And I would even say that not only should there be someone there with you professionally to guide you, but I think that you should go to follow-up appointments to make sure to touch base on the integration portion, make sure that whatever it is you unpacked and the trauma that you're able to touch base on, that you're able to really interact with it on a therapeutic level.
Yeah. And then, of course, there's the whole subfield of the microdosing that, you know, Silicon Valley became obsessed with, and it slowly spread from there. I have a physician friend of mine who's actually all for it, and he actually operates a clinic out of Austin. We butt heads quite a bit on it, because the microdosing, it's only good as long as you keep doing it. And like any substance you introduce to the brain, it has a way of accommodating it pretty quickly. So you need a higher and higher dose, which costs more and more money, right? So it's a vicious cycle. It has the same dangers as the more reputable psychotropic medications that are prescribed by psychiatrists, right? It's only as good as you continue taking it, right? And that's why it's often, you know, paired with talk therapy, because the idea is that the medication is a crutch. It's not the problem itself. You have to address the symptoms for sure, but the symptoms are just an indication of the underlying issue, whether that be adult trauma, whether that be childhood trauma, whether that be a poor sense of self or a negative identity. You know, all those things have to be addressed. Otherwise, the symptoms will continually find a way to come out at some point.
I take issue with the fact that it's only popular because it came about of Silicon Valley's hyper-efficient kind of capitalistic model, as opposed to like a therapeutic model. But I'm really also curious as to what you think about maybe macro doses of psilocybin mushroom. I've seen a lot of promising research that one dose, like a heavy dose of like 3 to 5 grams or so, might be beneficial. And I'm curious if like something like that, like one-time macro doses, might have benefit in terms of depression, anxiety, or trauma, at least that you've read.
Well, absolutely. And I mean, you can look at it from two perspectives. One, the neuropsychological perspective, and two, the psychoanalytic perspective, you know, that whole thing with Freud and the id, ego, superego, right? A lot of pop psychology are familiar with. So I'll start with the psychoanalytic perspective. The ego creates a series of defenses. And when in the world we encounter things that we can't, our mind, it refuses to address or can't wrap our minds around, we use an ego defense in order to fight against it. And those are like denial, repression. Some of the advanced defenses are even some things like humor. And you might say, well, humor is a great thing. Why is it a bad thing? Well, if you're confronting serious situations that demand taking seriously and you're making a joke of it, you know, like somebody's death, because you can't work through the emotions, the negative emotions that come with something like that, then it becomes a real problem. And so we get in the habit of using these defenses. And because we function optimally, we typically narrow it down to a set of 1 to 3 go-to defenses that we apply to all things that we find difficult. And what the psychedelic does is it completely dissolves those ego defenses, makes the ego essentially take a lunch break, and allows you to address all of that unconscious material that you had previously put into this closet and locked up, right? And so when you come out of such a trip, assuming that it's gone correctly and it hasn't been a bad trip, then all of that is now infused into your sense of self. You now are whole again, and you have a better understanding of yourself, better understanding of the world, and the way that to interact, right? Now, from a neuropsychological perspective, when we're born, we start developing those neural pathways, and think of them as like highways and surface streets. And at the beginning, neurons are firing and they're going through like cars through all of those streets. But the mind, like any other part of our body, is tempted to optimize for the sake of efficiency. And so it starts shutting down those streets or those highways that get less traffic. And so you develop these certain fixed neural pathways, and they can be either adaptive or maladaptive. And furthermore, they can have been adaptive at one point in your life, but now no longer serve a self-preservation purpose. And they're actually harming you in your life now, right? But once those pathways are fixed, it's hard to undo them. So what the psychedelic essentially does is it opens up all those streets again, turns on all of the streetlights, and reconfigures those neural pathways for a new shorter, not a new shorter, but a more optimal way of incorporating all of those street systems.
Yeah, definitely. I like what you said there regarding those systems no longer serve you in terms of self-preservation, but like our body and our brain still wants to utilize them. So I think you're right. Psychedelics, like the classical psychedelics or a large dose of psilocybin or something, is a great way to shake you out of those patterns that might not necessarily be beneficial to you anymore. To circle back, what obstacles would we need to overcome for the military to take these into consideration for treatment of their vets?
Well, I mean, let's separate the two. Your question is, how do we address the vets, from the military perspective? But the two are separate, right? So the VA system handles the vets once they're on the civilian side. The military handles the service members, right? And there's a different set of regulations and procedures that go along with the treatment of each of those populations. I will say it's probably more likely to get adopted with the VA before it would be in the military, just because, aside from any research that might come out, the military typically is very, very rigidly adherent to processes that might be outdated, just for the sake of tradition sometimes. We've done it this way and we'll continue to do it this way. I mean, one of the Army's mottos is, if it ain't broke, don't fix it, right? So it's a little bit slower sometimes in certain sectors for the military to adapt with certain things that are being done on the civilian world.
I see. So we still got a little bit of way to go until our military services are able to utilize, guided psilocybin treatments or guided LSD or ketamine treatments in order to overcome their particular ones.
If I could input it all,
I would say after my deployment, definitely psilocybin really helped me deal with depression, as well as actually help tamper down some of the alcoholism without even knowing it. Without like context of what alcoholism really was at the time. But the psilocybin really, I had two or three macro doses after my first deployment, and it really put me in a mindset that kept me from killing myself. Because I would have a renewed sense of life. I'd be, instead of focusing on the past or having anxiety about the future, I had both. It gave me a renewed sense of how beautiful the world was. Even though I had seen or experienced bad things, regardless of where I was at, the world was still a good place. It wasn't inherently bad. And I credit psilocybin and LSD 25 with not, especially post-military, helping me out. But post-wise, I think the VA, I mean, we could see potentially maybe the VA in Oregon, state by state level, possibly opening up and maybe offering treatment if it's shown it. Oregon's very progressive.
The VA system is a federal entity. So regardless of what state legislatures are doing, yeah, it's a long shot is what I'm saying.
Oh, yeah, exactly. And I agree with you both in the sense that I think they're more appropriate for the post-use, more appropriate for our veterans, just to make sure that they can handle what they've undergone throughout that time.
Because if they're in the service, there's still missions to be done, right? You don't want to complicate their reliability.
Yeah, exactly. And I can understand how that can get in the way for sure.
Well, I just worry about also the is because, I have a very liberal point of view on this, which is if you just legalized all the drugs, you'd have a lot less of the symptoms that you saw in the barracks when I was in the service, which is you had a lot of opiate use, which also permeated into a culture of crime and organized crime within the ranks. Like I saw gang members, selling drugs of all sorts throughout the barracks.
Wow.
And it was very common, even before we knew about the opiate epidemic, people were going through withdrawal problems. And then post getting out, the quickest answer was usually Paxil or an SSRI or some traditional form of pharma. And it was after talking to nobody with any background with psychology or mental health, but just a general practitioner that was going, oh, you're feeling a little sad, you're feeling anxiety. Well, here, let me bring in the sales rep and he'll talk to you. And if you look at what Paxil has done, some of the symptoms and some of the side effects are just ridiculous. Yeah. You know, a lot of people don't put thought into their healthcare. And so when the doctor gives them a prescription, you know, they trust the doctor. And I don't think that a lot of people really understand or bother to look up, you know, like how the protocols are supposed to be implemented. And this is what really scares me with psychedelics coming online, especially being pushed forward in a exploitive manner by capitalism, has been just, you know, you're going to crack some people off. I have somebody down here that says they're a MDMA prescriber, you know, who's done a $200 online course. And I can only can't imagine the resonating damage that he is doing by giving out his untested MDMA to people and then disappearing, you know, no follow-up, no treatment, doesn't believe in CBT, doesn't, you know, nothing else. And it's like, how, you know, not even working out or fitness or nutrition, you know? And it's just, to me, it's not holistic. It's not logical. It's like, why would you put yourself through this? And that's a whole different question on ethics and morals altogether, right?
But, you know, you could see how a lot of those issues you mentioned overlap between the use of psychedelics and the use of the completely legitimized medications that are being prescribed.
Oh, yeah, definitely. I think it's just a matter of time before it all becomes a big it's going to be a very interesting next few decades for pharma, I think, for big pharma, especially with the doors opening up with the research from COVID. I mean, you said it perfectly, right? The nail right on the head is that with the loosening regulations, you're just seeing some of the sharks come out of the water. And I'm coming from traditional cannabis where I saw what I thought was the worst of the worst. And now you're throwing some of these mind-altering substances, which really open people's minds to suggestion. And I'm worried. Like, you know, you can go into the MK Ultra, you know, conspiracy theory, but I'm a true believer that you give a person enough LSD and you tell them something, you know, they might start to believe it. And I'm worried about cults popping up. I'm thinking about what are we going to see in 30, 40, 50 years downstream from this kind of like policy right now? You know, we've seen what's happened from the war on drugs and an abstinence only policy. And we've seen how that's kind of failed and how, you know, harm reduction models are a little bit more effective, you know, handing out needle exchanges, such as like that, pharmacological replacement therapy. Those are options. I mean, the toolboxes are getting bigger, but, you know, we really have to take into consideration, you know, some of these really could have an effect way downstream that we're not even considering yet. And I fall in the same camp where it's like, I'd rather be safe than sorry, especially with everybody being so connected and interconnected. We could be starting the next, you know, Third Reich, Fourth Reich. We'd be starting the next Jonestown. Who knows what could happen, you know?
Yeah. Well, one of the things to watch out for, here's just a scenario that could play out. Let's say tomorrow the government legalized MDMA. All of these underground supporters of it for the therapeutic value of it are jumping and cheering. Finally, we have our day, right? How long would it take before the big pharma sends lobbyists to DC to alter federal regulations so that it's easy for them to implement MDMA into their prescription medications, but make it harder for mom and pop clinics who offer MDMA services to open up, right?
What I'm seeing in my specific field consistently.
Right.
I come more from the idea that FDA guidelines is the way to go. I mean, as much as people will use narcotics in non-traditional settings or on clinical settings, like that's just going to be part of life. But I think, you know, nobody should be in a jail cell for doing that unless they're doing active harm. And that's where the question really comes in. Is the mom and pop like operations, whether it be cannabis, MDMA, psilocybin, LSD-25, are those ethically and morally okay if they don't know what the hell they're doing and they're giving out this medication? Because is it going to be more of a problem during this transition to say what may could be healthier? Or is this possibly opening the door to make things worse? So I worry that, you know, like, you know, a lot of the research coming out is tainted by either side, whether they're be for or against. Everybody's got an agenda. And so I really, I don't even know where to stand on it. So I'm listening to the people that are smarter than me, which have degrees like you two. So
I definitely see where you're coming from there. I worry a lot about what kind of stuff we're stirring up in, like, because I, like, in timelines of like 500 to 1,000 years, like, what are we stirring up with this Great Awakening? What's actually going on? But what you said in regards to like a strictly FDA approved model, I definitely agree with that. But I also think that we need to give room to the indigenous populations and the ceremonial aspects they brought in, which might not necessarily have an FDA definition.
Well, one of the issues there is, I mean, as we know, the trips that people would take to Peru, what is the substance that escapes me now?
Ayahuasca.
Ayahuasca trips, right? So it became a big thing pretty quickly, once again, because of Silicon Valley and a lot of those folks. And so what you've seen is it expanding across South America, where they're offering like almost like vacation packages, right? And you don't necessarily have any of those old school, well-versed medicine doctors doing the administration. It's somebody's cousin or uncle, right? Because they needed more people because they have more demand, right? And so that's where it gets kind of mucky.
Exactly. I've heard that a lot with the expansion of ayahuasca tourism, which I don't think it should be tourism, but ayahuasca tourism, it's sort of been able to, there's just so many fake curanderos and fake healers coming out of the woodwork selling their snake oil, and is trying to take advantage of people who are really there for healing. And that whole, that particular model brings another thing into consideration, because a lot of people look into ayahuasca and those types of very powerful entheogens as like their last ditch effort, their last resort after so many things have happened to them, or they're on so many medications, whatever the case may be. And that retreat model is not necessarily accessible by the people who need it. I mean, I know I personally can't go down to Peru for 10 days. That's ludicrous to most people.
Right.
So I think that's the biggest hurdle, is being able to make sure the medicine actually gets to the people that needs it.
Well, and also reminding yourself that all of these things that we're talking about are alternative treatments. They're not first line treatments. People considering these things should at least exhaust the talk therapy and the medications that are covered by the insurance they already carry, right? Now, I said it earlier and I'll say it again, that if they're prescribed medications, the onus is on them, unfortunately, to also request talk therapy to go with it, because it's very easy for primary physicians now to diagnose and prescribe for mental health disorders, but they don't necessarily go so far as to say, hey, I highly recommend you see somebody week to week on top of that.
Yeah, definitely. I want to circle back a little bit. You talked a little bit about your concerns and all of our shared concerns regarding cannabis and adolescence. I would love to hear your particular thought. I have a lot of personal concerns. I think that our current adolescent population is overprescribed with things like Ritalin and Adderall and Vyvanse and other types of things. I'm curious as to what your thought is, especially with your background. Because I'm not a clinical psychologist. I can't speak too much on it. I just have my own opinion.
Well... What I saw, unfortunately, in my career so far, I earlier on when I was doing my practicum experience as part of my doctoral program, I was doing psych and neuropsych testing. And it was in a affluent area of California, Orange County and Newport Beach and Irvine area. And you'd have parents that come in with their teenagers saying, essentially, my kid's broken, can you fix them? And accusing them of having ADHD, when really they just have some of that, natural energy that adolescents sometimes express a little bit more than others, and we shouldn't pathologize it, right? The issue with ADHD is it's oftentimes an easy way out for people, and ignore the possibility that it's actually anxiety disorder. All right. Because remember, I said that, those anxiety folks are time travelers, right? They're not spending their time in the present. Well, that's a hallmark of having ADHD. I can't focus on what I'm doing in front of me, right? So what really matters is the content of the thoughts. Okay, so you couldn't focus on the page that you were trying to read. Where did your mind go? So sometimes the response will be nowhere, just kind of disappeared, went into space. Other times, I'm worried about this test I have next week. There's a difference between the two diagnostically.
Yeah, that's a great way to put it. That's a great way to put it.
Do you think that overprescription could possibly be leading to people actually having ADHD or ADD possibly?
Oh, I mean, it'd be far-fetched for anybody to respond to that question directly. What we do know is there's complications that exist when you start somebody off on medication, specifically ADHD medications at a younger age, and then they're on it for quite some time. What you find is that irritability goes up, not only in the aftermath of terminating that medication, but in some cases you find you prolonged period of time, if not permanently, you're just kind of a short-tempered person, right? It's this almost this angst in the absence of the satisfaction you got from the medication.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I mean it is a legal amphetamine, right? And so sometimes. There's a perceived euphoric effect initially before that sustained attention period, right? That lasts anywhere between 30 minutes and an hour or so. And for some folks, that's exactly the effect they're trying to achieve. Not the long-term sustained attention. They're really hooked on that essential euphoria. And if they go off the medication and that was their aim, then they're gonna maybe divert to other substances that are gonna provide that feeling again.
Yeah, and that kind of harkens back to what you said, that a lot of these substances, pharmacological or plant-based, the real key to the healing is being upfront with what the issue is and not just putting a band-aid over it, being able to actually approach and interact with either the trauma or the anxieties and being able to be a little bit more mindful in that sense.
Absolutely.
I definitely want to be mindful of your time, Lorenzo. I know that we've talked for a little bit here. I want to ask you just a couple more questions. First off, what's something that you wish you would have known whenever you entered the military? What's something you wish someone would have told you?
I wish somebody would have told me to do it sooner,
Oh yeah?
honestly.
Okay.
I had the contract right in front of me with the military recruiter when I was 17. I was going to do Army Airborne Ranger. And on the day that I had to sign the contract, I had to bring mom in because I was underage. And at the very last minute, right in front of the recruiter sitting at his desk, she says, "I can't do it because if you die, it'll be my fault." And we had to do a 180 out of there. And I felt embarrassed and I was upset with her for a few weeks. But we could say everything happens for a reason because I like exactly where I ended up.
Everything does happen for a reason. Well, in that case, I know you're working on your professional development course as well, but I wanted to ask you a little bit about Operation Art. Would you expand on that?
Oh yeah, so it's something I'm trying to kick off right now. I did it via a crowdfunding campaign during my last deployment, ironically, and it got some funding, but not enough to be able to sustain launch. So I terminated it and refunded everybody their money. And then just a few months ago, I found out that the VA was doing this nationwide contest to try to find solutions, either conventional or unconventional, to combat the suicide issue amongst the veteran population. And I said, "Well, let's bring br blow you know blow the dust off and bring that back out and see if I could fit that to get it launched again." And they're actually delayed in coming out with their first round finalists, but any day now, I should find out if I'm amongst them. So the basic idea is it's a traveling art therapy workshop that I would go to the VAs, but I wouldn't actually set up shop inside the VA hospital. It would be in the parking lot. We have this trailer. We set up the easels in the parking lot in the dedicated cordoned off space, and they're interacting with nature while connecting with their creativity in a therapeutic manner that allows them to remove themselves from any perceived stigmas that come with being in the clinical environment.
Yeah, that's amazing. I often t my girlfriend's going to school to finish her art therapy degree, and I'm always over her shoulder, kind of reading some of her books, and it is really interesting the stuff that they're coming up with in terms of art therapy. For example, she was showing me an article about students who are just now entering the school force who have not really been exposed to the classroom very much because of COVID in the past few years. So
All
art
right.
therapy has been incredibly powerful to really bring them out of their heads and pull them out of their anxieties and put them back in the classroom.
Yeah, and one of the reasons for that is because it's indirect. Hey, we're just going to do some art today. We're going to learn a few things about ourselves, and that's very disarming to folks. It's not like sitting in front of a clinician and feeling at times interrogated, depending on the style of the interviewer.
Yeah, exactly. That's awesome. I really hope to see Operation R not only on the finalist list, but I really think that could be groundbreaking for our vets. Awesome. Well, other than that, Lorenzo, that's everything I have for today. Do you do anything online where listeners can find you?
No, I mean, I have an Etsy shop. My therapy is doing artwork. So I tend to sell things because my wife is tired of looking at them sitting around the house. So, but other than that, I don't have a private practice, you know, full-fledged in the military. And, you know, speaking of that, I just want to, you know, end with everything that I've said by, you know, reminding you that this is my personal opinion, right? So it's not the opinion of the military. These are just my personal thoughts that I've shared. And of course, infusing my background, my education, my experiences into some of those thoughts. I will say that I like that there's these forums like you're doing right now, because it's generating future thought, right? And some folks who have a very rigid opinion on the subject, if they could at least spend a few minutes with material like this to bring something alternatively into the picture, that's the biggest thing that we need right now, right? It's why we have such a political divide, why our nation is kind of fractured right now, because people have these very rigid perspectives that they're unable to separate from, because they've incorporated them into a sense of identity. And of course, they're going to hang on to that.
Yeah, definitely. I think you're right. There's a lot of either dogmatic or rigid type of ideals whenever it talks about these types of things and talks about healthcare and therapy as a whole. So I think it's important to at least have the conversation, like you said, just spend a little bit of time with it. Awesome. It's been an honor to host you. So thank you so much, Lorenzo, for appearing on the show. I appreciate you tuning into this week's episode of Plants Save My Life, featuring Dr. Lorenzo Aranda, clinical psychologist with the U.S. Air Force. I also want to shout out my friend Jordan Curl of Growers Without Borders for support and providing his perspective on this week's episode. If you like this episode, please feel free to send it off to someone who you know would enjoy it. We'd also be eternally grateful if you were to rate us 5 stars and follow us wherever it is you get your podcasts. For questions, comments, and community, head over to our official Instagram at plantsavemylife.pod. Until next time, everyone, have a beautiful week!